Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. David McCullough was one of the nation's most decorated historians, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes, 2 National Book Awards, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Today we discuss History Matters, a posthumous book by McCullough, edited by his daughter Dori McCullough Lawson and his longtime researcher Michael Hill. Both join us this morning. Welcome, Dori, and welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy. Good to be with you.
So talk a little bit about the impetus for this book. And his writings ring as true today as when he wrote them. So talk a little bit about why you wanted to put this book together.
Well, Mike and I were working for a long time since he died with his papers. He left behind file cabinets, boxes, almost a football field in length if you line the papers up. And we were going through those. And at the time, his publisher knew we were doing that. And they've sort of said, you know, if you see anything, let us know. And there was no other book. There's no David McCullough book waiting to be published. But we did start to see elements of something that maybe could be put together into a book. And we knew the 250th anniversary of the country was coming up. But also as it was taking shape, we were taking a small amount out of this huge collection of papers. Mike and I wanted to, show more of him, to give people a sense of the person that we both knew and worked with and for so long. And so we were keeping our eye out for sort of David McCullough wisdom, what the feeling of sitting on the back porch with him having coffee was like. And some more serious essays too. Yeah.
And Dori, you began working with your father in 1992. And in the preface of the book, you talk about a conversation with his publicist about what to call your father. Tell us about that conversation and what you decided on.
Yes. This was soon after Truman came out, and the publicist at Simon & Schuster she kept sort of hesitating and not knowing what to call him when she was talking to me. She didn't like saying David to me, and she didn't want to keep saying your father. And so she stopped us right in a conversation early. And most of this then was in writing. You know, we would be writing to each other about him. And she said, "What are we going to call him? Because I don't want to do this, wonder what to say to you." And she decided it's going to be D. McSee. And so from then on in writing, I didn't call him that. I didn't refer to him when I was speaking about him. But when I was writing about him, emailing about him with people who I worked with often, I would refer to him and they would refer to him as D. McSee.
And Mike, you also had a very close relationship with him as his research assistant for 40 years.
Yeah, Mindy, it was an extraordinary experience during those 40 years. And I've been thinking a lot while Dori and I were working on this book about some of the things that I really treasure and remember about working with him. And one of them was just the intense curiosity he had about everything. It wasn't just who he was writing about at the time. He was interested in art, architecture. He loved to sing. He loved to dance. His curiosity was unlimited. The other was that these amazing partnerships that he would establish with archivists, librarians, curators, and so forth, and he would bring them into the process, and that always made things so much more wonderful. And there are countless things that they brought to our attention that if David hadn't established that partnership, might not have come to the fore. And the last is that, and Dori might want to talk a little bit more about this, is that whenever he finished a significant section of a book or a particular scene, he wanted to go see the real place where it happened in order to get a connection with that. He wanted to go see where John Adams and Abigail lived and the desk that they wrote their incredible correspondence from, to see St. Gaudens' studio, to see where the Wright brothers did their tests. And it was a wonderful, wonderful thing that he did. And it really kind of created this connection and intimacy with whatever he was writing about.
Mm. Dori, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. I would add that what interested me very much about him going to the places where these events happened, running through the Capitol as the national Capitol, the US Capitol, as Truman had when FDR died, or climbing to the top of the tower in Philadelphia, he had already written the scene in the book. He would write it before he went, and then he would go, as he said, to see what he got wrong. And I just love that approach because I think we're always also concerned about, doing everything right, doing everything right. But his assumption always was, I'm doing things wrong here. And what's wrong with it?
Oh, interesting. So there, as you mentioned, there's a lot of material to consider. How did you decide what you would include in the book?
Well, we were looking for things that were either not published or had been published for very small, limited audiences, little, particular things that he had done, say for a newsletter, or may have shown up in an alumni magazine, so that it was a small audience. And then, as I said, we were looking for things that really shed light on him.
And you certainly accomplished that because I read, there was so much in, we'll get into some of that, but so much that I went, oh, that's like so interesting, right? To really get that insight into who he was.
And
He
we also were looking,
yeah,
sorry,
no,
we
go
also
ahead.
were looking, he was interested at the end of his life in writing a book about writing. And so we were looking particularly for things about writing that he had already written or given a speech about. And Mike and I are interested in that as well. I mean, that's the fun of doing a book like this. You can just do what you want to be in the book, and somebody else might do a very different book if they were doing this. But Mike and I had the pleasure of picking what we liked.
And Mike, you mentioned his about his curiosity. He really loved what he did. You know, some people think, oh, I got to get up and go to work today. Nope, he loved it every day.
Oh, he sure did. And he was thinking all the time about what he was working on or what he might want to work on in the future. And I came across recently a 4-page handwritten letter that he wrote me one day when he was working on Greater Journey. And he had come up with the idea of using the artist Mary Cassatt as a major character in the next part of the book. And he wrote this 4-page handwritten letter explaining why he thought she would be a wonderful character to include. He was thinking all the time, and it was a joy to be part of that. And the other thing is that I remember talking to some historians or curators who had worked on a collection or something for 40 years, and David would ask a question, and they would pause and say, I've never been asked that question before.
That curiosity. It's great we get this early look at his life as well, right? And I was very tickled in a part where it was written, when McCullough would be invited to speak at colleges in those early years, his businessman father would say, "Great, maybe they'll offer you a job."
There were some lean years for sure.
Talk about, get sort of a synopsis, if you will, of his early start, his early career before he became so well known.
Well, he went, I'll start way back. He went to Yale. He was an English major. After he graduated from Yale, he went to New York, and he worked at a new magazine called Sports Illustrated, on the business side. And then he went to work for Time Incorporated. He then went to Washington during the Kennedy administration, and he worked for the United States Information Agency, and he was the editor of a magazine that the United States published for the Middle East. And after that, he went back to New York, and he was an editor at American Heritage Magazine. And in the late 60s, he wrote his first book, The Johnstown Flood, while he was still working at American Heritage. So he worked on it at night and on the weekends. And that came out in 1968. And soon after that came out, he decided, with five children and no, trust funds backing them up, he and my mother decided that he would leave his job and try to write full time. And so they moved the family from White Plains, New York to Vermont, where we lived for 2 years. And he started to was working on the Great Bridge then. And so then it was many years. It actually ended, it was about 20 years of him writing, and his books were published, and he was critically acclaimed. But the wolf was always at the door, very much so. And we were aware of that, and my grandfather saying, maybe they will offer you a job, comes, I'm sure, in those
In
years.
those early years, yeah.
He had a bestseller. His first bestseller was The Path Between the Seas, which was a book about the building of the Panama Canal, which happened to come out. He worked on it for 7 years, and then it happened to come out right as the Panama Canal treaties were an issue. And so the timing of that was good. And Truman, really, which came out in 1992, Truman was the sort of breakthrough book in many ways, and that he'd already won two National Book Awards, but Truman sort of launched him into a different realm.
And you mentioned the Panama Canal book coming out, the timing, and he has some thoughts about luck, right? I mean, luck, you write about that, or you know, there's writing in the book about his thoughts on luck, Mike. What did he think about luck?
Well, he thought that luck was such an important part of how American history evolved. And there's a wonderful speech in there that he did at Providence College about luck figuring into history. And one of the great examples that he uses was that during the Revolutionary War, when George Washington had to evacuate New York, so because the British were just had them outnumbered, and so they started the evacuation in the middle of the night, and they weren't completed, and they were afraid the British were gonna find out. But then this fog moved in, and it covered the rest of the departure. And David used that as a perfect example of luck. And the other two is how fortunate, many times, that our nation has been by the leaders. And he talks about George Washington and the luck that we had to have him, this man of incredible dignity and character, be the first person at the helm of this nation.
I was really interested in that chapter on George Washington because I also think George Washington was pretty great. So it was interesting to see that that was one of David McCullough's favorite people, right?
Yes, he thought he was the greatest American.
In that same commencement address to Providence College, I also love this. It says, "Brilliant Danish physicist Niels Bohr, who had a horseshoe over his door, was asked once by a skeptical colleague whether he believed in such nonsense. 'Oh no,' Bohr said, 'but I'm told that it works even if you don't believe.'"
Great one.
And I think after he learned about that, a horseshoe went up over our kitchen door.
So funny. We're talking with Adore McCullough Lawson and Mike Hill about the book History Matters, posthumously produced by Essays by David McCullough. And we'll talk more after a quick break.
I like this hook. I really like it, you know. I'd rather not have it, if you can understand what I mean. Two hands are better than one. I can't even sit somewhere and clap for people that are performing. You think I don't like them? You know, I can do this. I can't really clap. I can't make an ice cream cone without fracturing the cone as I'm making it. A lot of little things you can't do, you know?
Drummer Victor Multi Moulton in Plymouth. You're listening to WCAI, local public radio for the Cape Coast and Islands.
I can't slap you in the face with my left because I don't have a hand there. Whatever.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about History Matters, a posthumous book by David McCullough, edited by his daughter, Dori McCullough Lawson, and his longtime researcher, Michael Hill. Mike, you mentioned his interest in architecture, sort of touched on that. And what is it about? It's not just people and events that he was in. He was interested in all kinds of history. Talk a little bit about what it was he thought architecture, how it helped us now.
I can jump in.
Yeah, Dory, please. Thank you.
Is that right? he thought that the spaces that were around us and what we surround ourselves with are tremendously important in showing what kind of people we are, that it's important to have sense that he loved proportion in architecture, and he talked often about proportion. And he would say, you know, it matters how wide the window is, how tall the window is in relation to the size of the wall. What are the dimensions of this room? Because there are certain dimensions that feel good to people. He was fascinated that people in the olden days had a natural sense of proportion. And they didn't necessarily have to be trained to know that. They just knew how it made you feel to be in it. So he liked architecture as at a human scale, but he also thought of it as an accomplishments of a society. So big pieces of either, I would just include design in mm-hmm. architecture, like the Golden Gate Bridge, or the cathedral at Rouen, or really, I mean, any building, he was fascinated by it.
Yeah, it goes and back to
light, which also he liked. He was very interested in how light played on buildings. He was a painter, mm-hmm. and so looking at light was tremendously, and color was tremendously important to him. And he thought that architecture figured largely as an art form.
And there's something we learn in the book too. There was a time where he thought he might be a professional painter.
Yes, he did. He studied painting at Yale, and he painted a lot. And actually, the first summer that he came to visit my mother on the vineyard, which was 1954, he got a job at SBS, the grain store, and carrying the grain bags to the trucks and all that, he started to think, I think I like painting. And so he painted that whole summer, and he had a show at the Sculpin Gallery, and he sold his paintings at the Sculpin Gallery, and he thought that may be what he would do.
Yeah. Let's talk to Paul, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Dory, I am your family's neighbor around the corner from Music Street. I live right next door to the Congregational Church. Hello.
Hi, Paul. I know who you are.
Right. Hi. Lovely to hear this program about your dad, who I was very fond of. And I believe that Mike might have been at the church when we had the memorial service. Jeffrey introduced Mike, and he spoke a few words, if I'm correct anyway.
Yes.
I just wanted to share with the listeners that your dad and I had many conversations over the years. I would ride my bike down Music Street. He actually stopped in my driveway a couple of times when I was out front. My younger sister married a doctor and moved to Pittsburgh, and I would share that with your dad, but he never seemed to be that interested in speaking about his years in Pittsburgh, but he was very interested when I told him that I had been teaching English in Vietnam. And we had some great conversations. We miss him very much. And as you know, in the local West Tisbury Library, we have a lovely photograph of he and your mom, Rosie. And it's just great to hear you people on the program and to let you know that I have probably 10 of your dad's books, and I've only read through half of them, but it's a chore for a long winter.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Paul.
Thank you for sharing that, Paul. We appreciate that. If you have a memory you'd like to share, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We can only imagine how many times he was asked to give interviews, which was a lot. And you know, he was very proud of being interviewed by the Paris Review, and you included in the book. It's really interesting, but why is that one so dear to him?
That was so dear to him, I think, because when he first read the interview with Thornton Wilder that was in the Paris Review, it was that interview with Thornton Wilder that made him think, maybe I would want to be a writer. And he considered himself a writer more than a historian. He was a historian, but he really thought of himself as a writer. And to be interviewed by the Paris Review recognizes that. Whenever I worked with him all the many years with his appearances and giving speeches and traveling and, tours. And often for his name tags, they would want to know what is his title? And he always wanted writer or author rather than historian. And he thought like a writer. He looked at everything as a writer would, looking at sort of structure. He would say, if we were all in the kitchen and my mother was by the refrigerator and my brother came in from the side and said something, he would say, "Oh, that's like a scene in a play." or that would be a great beginning to a novel. And he was seeing that sort of the structure of the world as a writer all the time.
Yeah. I thought that whole chapter was so interesting. He talks in that interview about his writing process, his typewriter, what he reads. We really get a sense of how he worked and his thought process.
Yes. And Mindy, just on that, on the Paris Review interview, Dory and I felt it was important to include that because it did give you a look inside of his writing process. But the other thing I remember in working with him too was that that as we were working on a project, the lists of things that he would give me to look at, and you really got a sense that he was always looking at things not the way other authors had looked at it, but in a whole new different way, through different characters and so forth. And I think that what's great about this book is that it not only gives his sense about the importance of history, but as Dory said before, the last section about writing, I think it's a wonderful book for somebody who might be an aspiring writer, either of history or historical fiction or even novels.
Yeah.
And the book lists included in there are books that influenced him and so forth, we thought was important too. So I think it's a wonderful book for aspiring writers to read.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the stuff about his typewriter. I mean, Mike, you and I are old enough to remember. We used to use the typewriter, too. And I remember when the computers came on the scene. For the longest time, I had that typewriter in the closet and desk behind me, just in case, right? In case this computer stuff didn't work out. But he stuck with the typewriter, right? He never went to the computer, Dory, right? It was always the typewriter.
No. He stayed with his typewriter, and not only did he stay with the typewriter, he stayed with the same typewriter.
The same one, right.
The same typewriter. He bought it in 1965, used a Royal Standard typewriter. The cover of the book has him with a typewriter. It is not the Royal Standard. That was the one he traveled with. He would carry a little typewriter with him. So the photograph on the cover of the book is him working at the Truman Library. So that's not the typewriter, but the typewriter. There really was never anything wrong with it, and he was not a good typist. He typed with four fingers and very, very loudly. he loved the noise that it made, the little ding, and he loved the paper. He typed all of his drafts on second sheets, which are yellow, like newsprint. So all of his manuscripts are, every draft is a real draft with typing and his handwriting, and there are many, many drafts. He said that he was more of a rewriter than a writer.
Yeah. And it's amazing he was able to find typewriter ribbon.
DeRosa's in Oak Bluffs.
There you go.
and Denny DeRosa was devoted to the typewriter as Dad was, and helped keep it running.
Mary Beth is giving us a call from West Tisbury. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, and hi, Dory. It's nice to hear your voice. As you know,
I'm Mary Beth.
Your dad and your mom. And I do want to comment David should get a job at a university. I, as a member of the faculty at Cornell University, helped facilitate his coming to teach for us for a semester, as I'm sure you know. And I wanted to say to the audience that he was a fabulously successful teacher. He had a huge class of hundreds of students. I know some of them personally turned into historians because they were so turned on by his lectures. And but I also know that afterwards, because he'd been so successful, we asked him to come back again, and he said, no, it was too much work.
Mary Beth, he loved that semester so much. And the class that he taught, you'll remember the way that he taught it was he gave each student in the class a photograph, a historic photograph with no information about it. And he felt that that education needed more, students needed to be taught to take more risks, and that they also needed to have more imagination and be rewarded for imagination. So he gave each student a historic photograph and just said, here, this is what you need to study. This is what you need to write about this semester, and use everything at your disposal to try to figure out what this is. Talk to your grandparents, make phone calls, do whatever you can to figure out what this is, and then write a paper about it. Mm-hmm. And he loved that semester at Cornell.
And it was, I have to say, that's one of the most creative assignments I have ever known about. And I tell people about it sometimes as just a wonderful thing. And I know that David told me that what he had done was he just passed those photographs out at random. And he did tell the students that if they didn't want to write about the one they got, and they had someone they could trade with, they could do that, but they could only do it once. And he put them sort of on their honor that that's what they had to do. And they really took it as a great challenge.
Yeah. Mary Beth, thank you for sharing. What a great story. I noted this down in the book, too. He notes that history should never, ever be dull. It should never be made boring by boring teachers or boring writers. We are raising a generation of young Americans who, by and large, are historically illiterate. And that has to change. There's no better way to understand who we are and why we are the way we are, and where we may be heading, than by reading history from the good writers. And I can't imagine a world without books. So I can imagine I would imagine he would be a fabulous teacher. He'd be very interesting, you know, challenging you and fun to listen to. He would definitely never be a boring history teacher.
Mindy, and I think a lot of that was the enthusiasm that he brought to his love of history. It was infectious. And I remember when I first started working for him, that he would give me these small little assignments to test to see whether I could do the research and stuff. And this is when he and Rosalie and Dory were living in Washington, D.C. And he would have me come over to the house, and then he would review what I had done or what I hadn't done. And it was like a little tutorial, and it was just absolutely wonderful. And if I hadn't done something, he'd say, you might want to check that out, maybe check this out. And it was just wonderful. And it was so exhilarating to be in his presence, to be talking like that.
Yeah. Dory, we talked about his typewriter, but talk a little bit about the little building that he worked in on the vineyard in the backyard.
Oh, when we started to live on the vineyard year round, which was 1972, five kids, little house. No, there was no way he could work in the house. So they built a little 8x10 building at the back of the very back of the yard. And he at that time put a wood stove in it. Eventually he got electric heat, which would be somewhere that he could get away from all of us and work all day. And it's a fantastic little building. It is called The Office. sometimes people will call it The Shed or a studio, or his favorite was someone called it The Bookshop. He did like that one, but it's definitely The Office. And no one was to go out there unless it really was an emergency. Or something very important. And there were a couple of rules. Once you got sort of near the office, there was a barn. Once you passed the barn, you had to start whistling. Because if you just showed up at the office door, you'd give him a heart attack and scare him absolutely out of his wits. So you just start whistling at the barn.
Yeah.
And then there's a little gate that you go through. And he always said anybody shorter than they were short gateposts, not tall. If shorter than those gateposts, those kids can go anytime they want.
I love that. In that Paris Review article, this was my favorite part. He says, it's off limits to everyone but the grandchildren. They can come out anytime they will. The smaller, the better. That really gives us a little insight to him as well, right? I was like, oh, that's so sweet.
Yes, and also the little ones, it feels like a long way to go out there by yourself, so they don't go.
That's so funny. We're talking about History Matters, a posthumous book by David McCullough, edited by his daughter, Dori McCullough Lawson, and his longtime researcher, Michael Hill. And we'll talk more after a break.
A lot of people, you know, they'll come in and they say, you know, what's like Folger? And usually I tell them, like, we have nothing like Folger here. We have everything we have is much better than Folger.
Coffee roaster Elio Silva of Vineyard Haven.
To be able to sell something like Folger, I have to roast it and let kick around for 2 or 3 weeks or even a couple months and maybe sweep it from the floor. And that might be a little like Folgers.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about History Matters, a posthumous book by David McCullough, edited by his daughter, Dori McCullough Lawson, and his longtime researcher, Michael Hill. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. He had to have a great memory to remember those speeches, which were in the thousands, and you note that a vast majority were given without notes and tailored to the audience.
Yes. And he didn't remember them. He was a performer. I mean, he loved to be on stage. He was very good at it. He acted when he was younger. He was in an off-Broadway play in New York when he lived there. And the speeches weren't memorized, but he said that he would know what the beginning was going to be and what the end was going to be. And that he felt like he was going on the stage with a basket of goods, and he would just pick out of the basket different things. But he did always want to know about each audience where he would be speaking ahead of time. And he did. He tailored everything to where he was going to be.
Yeah. You've got some great chapters about different people and things that he wrote about. And there's a couple that I wanted. Harry Truman, of course, we have to bring up, was president for 8 years. It took your dad 10 to write his story. He had a lot of material to work with. Didn't know that going into that project.
Yes, and Mike can talk about the Truman Library and what they encountered when they took that on.
Yeah, Mindy, that was the first book that I worked with David on, and that's where I saw this relationship that he would establish with the curators or archivists, some of which whom had been there when Truman was still alive and would use the library as an office and independent. But we would go out there, and the first thing he would do is sit down with a couple of the archivists and say, this is where I'm focusing, this is where I'm headed. And the archivists say, well, you want to look at box 238 in the presidential papers or something like that. And then we'd do that. But the amount of material was extraordinary that he had to go through, not only the archival papers, but the oral histories. And he did a lot of personal interviews. There were people still alive who knew Harry Truman. So there was that element too. But the other thing is that he was doing that book at the same time he was hosting the Smithsonian World Series on PBS. So he was actually doing both of those at the same time. It was just an incredible time to work with him.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about that now, you know, and like John and Abigail Adams, all of the letters and all of this great stuff that you have, which is slipping away. And as a researcher, Michael, you have to be noticing that this is like a treasure trove to have all of that material. And now with letter writing sort of disappearing, a lot of that, you know, firsthand material is harder and harder to come by.
That's a really great question, Mindy. Not only correspondence, because people don't sit down and write long letters like they used to do. It's, you know, a quick email or a quick text or something like that. And the other is that people don't keep diaries or journals. And those are an essential part of a historians' process too. So unfortunately, I think we're starting to lose both of those. And it's a shame. And, you know, David used to say that if you want to become immortal, keep a journal and donate it to your local historical society.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too, what are you going to work on, right? And he believed that one thing led to another, right? And this goes back to his curiosity. He'd be working on one thing and get this little sliver of something else, and that would send him in the next direction.
Yes, he said that he didn't know how, he really know how he picked his subjects. I mean, he would have sort of a story of how it happened, but that there was like a click. Suddenly, this is what he wanted to do. And it would be a combination of one thing leading to another, and the story, the characters, and then always, what is there? What is the material? Because if the material isn't there, it wouldn't work. And he had a few times where he really lucked into some incredible material. When he was working on the Great Bridge, which is about the building of the Brooklyn Bridge, he went up to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, where they had the Roebling papers, and they let him into a room that was, they said a closet, but it was really a room. And it was a whole room of that hadn't been, no one had gone through it, of all kinds of things from the Roebling family. And so he had this brand new material to work with. And when he was working on The Path Between the Seas about the Panama Canal, the Goethals family on West Chop on the Vineyard had a collection of letters in the family that from General Goethals, and it made that made a big difference for him too.
Yeah, here comes that word luck again, right?
Mm-hmm. Mindy, one other on the book the Greater Journey that David worked on wrote. Of Americans going to Paris in the 19th century. It was very interesting in that because there wasn't an A to Z narrative where your character was born and then they died and so forth. And so as he moved along, he had to figure out which characters were going to come on stage next. That's where that Mary Cassatt letter came through, was that when he reached that period in the century, that he started basically auditioning characters by reading about that. And I remember with the Franco-Prussian War, he said, we don't know who we're going to do. So he said, find out who the American ambassador was there. So I found out it was Elihu Washburn from Maine, and he stayed there during the siege and the commune. And it's an incredible thing. And we stumbled across his diary and his letters at the Library of Congress, but we didn't know anything about that, and it became an incredible part of the book.
Mm. One of the, I think, great things about historians is they're almost like detectives sometimes, right? And you think, you know, how much has been written about Harry Truman or anything? But he always managed to find something new that we didn't know about, right? And I guess, Mike, that was part of your job, too, is help me find some of this stuff, right?
Yeah, and most of it was his direction. It was the Elihu Washburn is a perfect example, which was we got the Franco-Prussian War to deal with. We need an American. He said, go find out who the ambassador was. And then that led to finding out that his diary and letters were at the Library of Congress. But also there was a ton of archival material up in Livermore, Maine, at his house up there in the library and so forth. So yeah, it was one thing led to another, prompted by that question, and then a little bit of luck to find this treasure trove.
And I think also some of it comes from his approach really as a writer and the narrative approach to history. Because in his books, you are with the people. You are with the characters as they are progressing through the event or their life. You're not looking at it from now.
Right.
He wants to have you be right with them as things are happening. And in doing that, as a novelist would do, he wanted also to write for the five senses. So not only what were they doing, but what were they hearing? What were they seeing? What were they eating? What did it smell like? So as he tried to approach it in that way as a writer, I think that one thing leading to another, that led him to different questions to ask.
Yeah.
That give a lot of not just a chronology, but the atmosphere of where, when these events were happening.
Which is why it's so interesting, right? This is, you'll never read anything boring by David McCullough, right? Because you are, you're there, you're with the character. Even though you know what happens, you're going to learn things along the way that you didn't know, right? So it's what makes it so interesting.
There's one other anecdote. Again, about David pursuing avenues that other people didn't. When he was doing Greater Journey again, he said, see if you can find out if there was an American English paper published in Paris around the years that we were doing. And there was this paper that I found out up at the Library of Congress, Galignani's Messenger, which was published in English. And it was for the English living in Paris and Americans and so forth. And so we spent a lot of time going through that. And I remember asking one of the reference people up there, I said, have people looked at this before? He said, I've been here for 20 years and nobody's ever asked for that.
Interesting. Yeah. There is another story I really liked in the book, which was that he was moved by John F. Kennedy when he was running for president. And he had this great idea for him in the campaign, but how do you get it to him?
I would say that piece that's in the book, it's called Getting to Schlesinger, was one of the moments when Mike and I were going through the papers of, look at this. And it's, you know, a couple of very thin typing paper. Neither of us had ever heard about it. I've talked to my siblings. None of us knew anything about this, never had heard about it. And it's an essay that he wrote for himself describing this experience of being a 30-year-old American with an idea for John Kennedy, presidential candidate John Kennedy. He had an idea for something that he thought that Kennedy should say in a speech. And he was sort of running a test. Could one American with no connection to these people get a message to a presidential candidate? And the essay is how that transpired.
So fun. He was very concerned about a generation of young Americans who I mentioned earlier, he said, to a large degree, are historically illiterate. And there's a story in there where he's on the plane sitting next to a woman who is a doctor who's educated, and she doesn't like history. And he's asking her these questions, why? And she is doubting that the Holocaust ever happened. I just can't even imagine your dad's thought process when he hears something like that.
I would say devastated and angry. And his anger about historic illiteracy was real. But he also felt he's angry at all of us. He's angry it's all of our fault. It's not the teacher's fault. It's all of our fault if we don't know our history. And it's our responsibility to know our history.
Yeah. I'm sure you recall when the book American Spirit came out in 2017, The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. And we interviewed your dad on the show when that book came out. And I asked him what gives him hope for the future. And I wanted to play that. This is how he answered.
I closed a speech that I gave at Ohio University with a statement of my own feelings about the answer to your question. And if I may, I'd like to read it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
When bad news is riding high and despair in fashion, when loudmouths and corruption seem to own center stage, when some keep crying that the country is going to the dogs, remember it's always been going to the dogs in the eyes of some, and that 90% or more of the people are good people, generous-hearted, law-abiding, good citizens who get to work on time, do a good job, love their country, pay their taxes, care about their neighbors, care about their children's education, and believe, rightly, as we do, in the ideals upon which our way of life is founded. That's absolutely the way I feel. And I think it's the way most people, most Americans feel, deep down. Right. But we need leaders who will stand up and say that. We need leaders who will have the backbone, like Margaret Chase Smith did, to stand up against Joe McCarthy. If I may read what she said to him, a comparable crisis in our story. She was a senator from Maine, one of the very few females in the Congress at that time. She said, I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States senator. I speak as an American. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny: fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear. Now, that's as valid, that's as pertinent, as on target today as it was then, well over 50 years ago.
He said that in 2017, and boy, doesn't that still resonate today?
Yes.
Yeah. I wonder your thoughts on his thoughts on the future. What are your thoughts when you hear that, Dory? I mean, it's nice to hear his voice, I'm sure.
Very nice to hear his voice. Very proud of what he said, and that he said what he said when he did, and when he said he wasn't going to stand by and twiddle his thumbs in 2017. On the future, I think overall he said we can't expect the politicians to solve our problems for us. We are a good people. The country belongs to the people. And what kind of country do we want to have?
Yeah. I love what he says, I'm a short range pessimist and a long range optimist.
Yes.
And Mindy, he thought that history, understanding history, knowing history and so forth, could help us in difficult times. There's a great phrase where he says that history can provide aid to navigating perilous times. And it's incredible that he said that decades and decades ago. But it's by that he meant that lessons of history give us hope, yeah. A sense of perspective, tolerance, and the fact that when we work together is when we're at our best.
Yeah. There was one other little thing in the book that I have to mention because I thought this was so brilliant. He talks about the books at Christmas, that he would get the book at the foot of the bed, and you wake up in the morning, Christmas morning as a kid, and you've got this book. And he's saying, this is a great tip for parents and grandparents, right? You get to sleep in a little longer. And I thought, what a great idea.
Yes, it's a fantastic idea started by my grandmother and all of his grandchildren and now great-grandchildren. It happens for everybody.
Yeah. The book just made the New York Times bestseller list, right?
Sure did.
I'm sure you're pretty excited about that.
We're very, very happy about it. And we both just are so happy for my parents, for both my mother and my father, that this is here and that it is still resonating. Yeah. And that it's on the list.
Got about a minute left. Any closing thoughts?
I think I would just say that one thing I would like people to know more about him and what he cared about, and that he wrote about people and he lived his life by what he called the old-fashioned primary values, old verities, which courage, respect for one another, self-reliance, courtesy, devotion to truth, a loathing of hypocrisy. And what he said is that we can never forget the power of simple goodness.
Right. The book is History Matters, edited by Dory McCullough Lawson and longtime researcher Michael Hill. Thank you both for being here. Such a fun hour. Really interesting.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.